Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Politicians know it, so do you. The economy is all that matters these days. And how we respond individually to the economy is what Jonathan Pond is all about. Jonathan Pond is one of America's most respected financial commentators and investment managers. In his PBS specials, Jonathan has taught millions of Americans how to make the most of their money. He is widely sought as an objective and entertaining observer of the investing and personal financial planning scene and has made regular national appearances on all of the network and cable television stations. Joining us now in studio for the first time to talk about what he calls the new affluence and how to achieve it is Jonathan Pond. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Ann. What a delight to be here. I must say, I'm spending the day here, and I was mentioning to my acquaintances who are big shots in PBS and NPR about coming up here, and they said, you know, those people at WOSU are just great. It's an outstanding station. It's one that so many of the other stations, large and small, look up to. So congratulations. It's so great to meet you.
I know.
I had no idea you were, you know, it must be this fresh air and the academic stimulation around here, but you can't be 25 years old.
Oh, Jonathan. Jonathan Pond is in Columbus because he will be appearing on WOSU TV tonight to talk about his plan to get you and your family back on track financially. Watch Money Smarts with Jonathan Pond tonight at 8 on WOSU TV. If you want more information about that, you can always go to WOSU.org and learn more about it. Question for our listeners? I have no question. What are your questions for Jonathan Pond? 614-292-8513 and email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. There are no pitches today. It is pure
right.
Jonathan Pond, no pledge drive
what
today.
What an interesting time we're in.
Yes,
too.
So we got plenty of time. Merrill Lynch a few years ago started what it calls Merrill Edge, a way to attract and keep what they estimate is about 28 million households out there with $50,000 to $250,000 in assets, $50,000 to $250,000 in assets, which for many, many years and forever really has been almost utterly ignored. It wasn't enough to make it worth their while. Now they have Merrill Edge, and there's a New York Times article about that. There are other avenues out there as well for smaller investors. There's a company out there called LearnVest. I know you're involved with Life Tuner through AARP. What about these operations, and what can the little people get from them?
Well, it's like anything else where you're trying to learn about stuff, and that is some are better than others. Some have perhaps have a hidden agenda, but my sense is that the more information you can get, the more you can learn about money, the better off you are. I mean, you are your own best financial planner. You are your own best investment advisor. And I find so many people do very, very well on their own. One of the things I talk about in Money Smarts in the program this evening, but in the rest of my work, and that is there are so many areas of your financial life that you can control. Insurance, estate planning, debt. Once you can control the controllables in your life, then that which you can't control, which is investing typically and dealing with challenges we get because we all go through some hard times, you can stack the odds in your favor. So, yes, I applaud these efforts, and I would suggest that people look at them with a somewhat skeptical eye to see what kind of information they're presenting. It isn't that complicated. I mean, it really isn't that complicated. There's so many people in the financial planning industry. There are no barriers to entry. Anybody can call themselves a financial planner. They've got some credentials, which are some are very worthwhile, others aren't worth a thing. And so. Look at your own situation and see what you can do to control what you can control and stack the odds in your favor in what you can't.
That's what people, a lot of people feel like they're completely out of control, that they don't have. It's exactly what people feel like they don't have. What are the things that people do have a lot of control over, do you think, that they're maybe not paying enough attention to?
Well, the first thing, Ann, is to get the right kind of insurance at the right price. We all need certain kinds of insurance. 40% of renters, I would presume in this market, there are a fair number of renters, 40% of them have no insurance at all. It doesn't cost that much. You need health insurance, and there are ways to get health insurance if you're between jobs or your employer doesn't offer a health insurance policy. You need adequate auto insurance and so on, disability coverage for people, perhaps umbrella liability coverage, perhaps long-term care insurance. But once you get the insurance in place, it really only needs to be reviewed maybe every year. And you can certainly look for ways to find to save money, because insurance is a very expensive item in the family budget. Another area is estate planning. You know, go out and get a will, get other items. If you've got kids, you know, you have to decide who might be guardians should the worst happen for the kids. Again, another 40% of adults have no wills, and that's crazy. So get that done, and that only has to be reviewed if your circumstances change or the rules change, but typically not more frequently than every few years. You know, the debt issue, there's something that I've been looking at, and it'd be wonderful to introduce it here. I have a license plate, which unfortunately over the last year has attracted quite a bit of attention. It's 1%. That's what my license plate on my car, which, by the way, is worth about $500. It's a 94, I don't even know what it is. It's green. I know that. I hate cars. I just hate what cars do to families, but it says 1%, and the reason I got that was, hey, I'd love to be in the 1%. Who wouldn't? But that's not it. The reason I got it is I'm looking at the 1% solution, and this is what I want, and this is what I want the younger people to think about in the audience, and I want you, if you have younger people in your family, to bring this up to them, because by heavens, whew, and watch it, Jonathan. You know, the more you can teach your kids about money, the less chance you have of them moving back in with you later on in life. 1% means in two areas. One is you want to commit to saving 1% of your gross income every month. And let's look at a young couple that has $75,000 in income. They save $750 a month for each month for a year. And then the following year, increase that by 0.1%. I mean, that's easy to do. If you do that for 10 years, by the way, you've got $200,000 almost in the bank at 5% investment return, which I think is reasonably achievable. That's the 1% solution. On the debt side, particularly if you have credit card loans, commit yourself to paying off your debt each month with 1% of your gross income. Get rid of those loans. And yes, this is going to consume a lot of income, but at least you'll be getting on a good financial footing, because if you can be debt-free, you've got clear sailing ahead. You really have clear sailing ahead in your financial life. That's the 1%. That's starting to control areas of your life and that you can control, and that's important.
My guest is Jonathan Pond, PBS Financial Advisor, and you might have noticed we're not in a pledge drive. He's here for the whole hour. If you have a question or comment for Jonathan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jeff in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, what are some of the criteria you would use to decide what financial advisor to use?
That's always a tough question, Jeff. First of all, I wouldn't look very hard at credentials. Some of the highly regarded credentials, the people are basically commissioned salespeople, and that doesn't mean they might be a good financial advisor. Certainly, they could well be. But I would look at references, and particularly to find one is to ask acquaintances or coworkers who they use, and are they happy with them? People of similar financial circumstances to you. So it's don't go to a lunch, a free lunch. I wouldn't respond to a mailing. I wouldn't respond to these cockamamie awards that these people receive. There's one going around now. I don't know whether it's 6-star or something like that. It means absolutely nothing. So don't be enamored of credentials. You want somebody who's got experience, ideally someone who actually has a relevant background in the field, and they're not just recycling themselves into this field because they think it's it's a lucrative one. And then look at how they're paid. If they're paid by commission, fine. That's fine, but I have to understand that. If they're paid by fee, that's fine. But know up front how they're being paid.
Jeff, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. 614-292-8513, that's the number to call if you have a question or comment for Jonathan Pond. He's with us right now in the studio. He is going to be in Columbus. Well, he is in Columbus because he will be appearing on WOSU-TV tonight to talk about his plan to get you and your family back on track financially. Watch Money Smarts with Jonathan Pond tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. So today is Super Tuesday, biggest day of the year, really. It'll determine probably or possibly who will be running against Barack
That's
Obama
right.
in the general election in November. What do elections, what kind of impact do they have on our finances, if any? What about the market? We hear a lot of times it matters who gets elected president. What matters?
It really doesn't matter.
Short answer.
Historically, I'm not going to endorse anybody, but historically, Democratic administrations, at least from the standpoint of the stock market, the market fares better under Democratic administrations than Republican. However, that is a small increment of difference. Election years tend to be good years for the market, but again, you're looking at history, and history has a way of not repeating itself. I'm reminded, Ann, when you ask about the impact of presidents on our pocketbooks, of a remark, and I was a little kid at the time when my father was working, and these were in the days when it wasn't so, it was not divided in Washington. He was special assistant to three consecutive presidents, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. They would keep people in the White House, isn't that surprising, from previous administrations. Anyway, he was enormously frustrated, and one night he came home to our home in Bethesda and said, Jonathan, the federal bureaucracy eats presidents for lunch every day. And that's part of what it is. The founders of our government were geniuses to have this built-in checks and balances. And to the extent of our pocketbook, those checks and balances are something that keeps the investment markets on a relatively even keel. I think the one thing the investment markets like is divided government, not necessarily who's in charge, but divided government, to be blunt, means they're not going to get anything done of great significance. And that's a good thing. That's the way the founders. This Constitution is just an amazing document.
And they can't do too much damage, you're saying.
They can't do too much damage. And I don't worry about how the election is going to affect us. I think we've got a lot of problems, and the responsibility for those and the blame for those are equally shared. And we have to address them. And there are some real threats out there. We've had a wonderful open to the year. We've had a great 5 months. This year, for example, foreign stocks are up 13%. Last year they dropped over 20%. So we've had a good open to the year, and it's not going to continue like that this year. But we could end up having a pretty good year when, in fact, there are a lot of problems looming in the future, but we'll talk a little more later, I'm sure, in this program about how to invest in these kinds of markets.
We're going to take a break right now. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And there are many ways to connect with our newsroom. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or like our station on Facebook. And be sure to sign up for the Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to register.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, saluting the musical legacy of the world-famous Cotton Club, featuring dancer Ted Lewis Levy and Broadway singer Brenda Braxton March 14th through the 18th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
Partly cloudy skies and 35 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine for today and a high near 55. Clear skies tonight, a low of 38 degrees. A nice day for Wednesday, more sunshine and a high of 64. Some clouds Wednesday night, a low of 51. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
My guest is Jonathan Pond, PBS financial advisor. You've heard him many times. You've heard him many times before on this show. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go online to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and contact us that way. And Jason and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, Jason.
Hi. I got a question.
Okay.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I own a property in D.C. That's not for rent. And my question is, should one require an insurance from the tenant on the property while they're renting?
Okay, Jason. Yes, it would be beneficial, particularly to the tenant, for them to have a renter's insurance policy. And you, Jason, certainly need a policy on the property, not the least of which has a substantial coverage for liability, because if there's a problem in there, they're going to come after the landlord. So it's important for the renter to have the insurance. I don't know how you can enforce that they do, but it's also it's crucial for you to have the coverage as well.
Okay,
that's the law anyway. So I do have that protection on my side. I was wondering if I should make them have one too. But thank you for the answer.
Well, okay. Thank you, Jason. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, Jason. So times are hard. Times have been hard. I think since I started interviewing you 2.5 years ago, it's been the same. It's sort of much been the same drumbeat. Now you said things have been up. But is there, besides that, is there a reason not to be pessimistic long term? I mean, everything just seems to be a blip right now.
Yeah. The pessimists, we tend to focus on what we want to hear. And that's a big problem for people. If we think the situation is bad, we'll listen on the radio or whatever, read articles that we prefer to read articles that agree with our thoughts. And that's causing some malaise in people. Interestingly enough, this market has done the stock market did nothing last year, but actually rebounded sharply in the fourth quarter to offset losses earlier in the year, and have done relatively well this year. It set back a little bit, which is understandable. And for those many people who said, I just think this thing, you know, Europe's going to fall apart. I think Europe might fall apart. I think there's a good chance Europe will fall apart, but I'm not sure how that's going to affect the U.S. market, and I'm not sure how that's going to affect foreign stocks. Will it? We've got huge debt problems. We've got big problems in the states and municipalities. I mean, the list goes on. But, you know, Ann, that list has been that long for a long time. What you have to do is to sit there and say, I need to diversify my money, and I need to avoid the temptation to make major moves in what I do with my money. The ones who tend to react or overreact to events, either real or threatened, are just asking for trouble. I can't ask you to be, as I am, a contrarian And I look at down markets as a wonderful buying opportunity. It drives the people in my office crazy when the stock market is having a great day. It's way up, and I can't resist the temptation to sell. And vice versa, when it's pathetic, the market's down hundreds of points, I can't buy fast enough. That works. You look like a dope when you're doing it. It takes an awful lot of intestinal fortitude to do that. But that's what works. Over the long run, pay attention to this, pencil to paper. Over the long run, stocks beat bonds, bonds beat cash, and cash beats gold. It's always been that way. We have no evidence to think it's going to change. We're not in an entirely new environment. We have a lot of problems in our society, but over the long run, that's what happens. Stocks beat bonds beat cash, like treasury bills and CDs, and cash beats gold. That's the way it is, and I think that's a reasonable way to assume that you're going to proceed in the future. A lot of money has been made in the market in the last 5 months, by the way. A lot of money.
Jim in Delaware, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good. Hey, I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a young man in my 30s, got into a lot of credit card debt via college and whatnot. And now I have creditors calling me, my family, friends, anybody they can get their hands on to try and get me to take care of these, which I am trying to. I'm on disability, so I have a fixed income. I'm just kind of curious, how can I deal with these situations? Do I have any kind of rights? I'm making attempts to pay this back, but they just hassle and hassle and hassle. So.
Well, Jim, first of all, I don't think they should be calling acquaintances. There are rules on collection, and they may be overstepping their bounds on that. You might want to check on what rules they might be breaking. And the issue, I guess, my question is, do you think you're going to be able to pay them off, or will it be pretty much nigh impossible?
Well, I'm pretty much figuring I will be able to pay them off, but at the moment they're I probably have about $25,000 to $30,000 of debt, and that's on like three different credit cards. So, you're trying to keep my head above water. The amount that I can pay each month barely even covers the principal. So
okay, covers the minimum.
Know. Yeah,
I would check with a consumer credit counseling organization. And see. Now, that will go on your record, the fact that you have met with them. But then you can get an objective opinion. And that's not necessarily a big besmirchment on your credit record that you sought credit counseling. Check with the local consumer credit counseling organizations. Do not respond to a TV ad. Those people are, you know what they are.
Yeah.
Check with a local consumer credit counselor. I think you'd be they would let you know whether perhaps some sort of settlement might be able to be worked out or putting you on a payment plan. But you need somebody there going to bat for you. That would be the main thing to do right now, Jim. And good luck to you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Jim. Thanks for the call. We have an email from Gina. She wants to know, what can you tell us about lease purchase option houses?
Okay, this is known as rent to buy, and it can work. It's where perhaps there's a landlord who would want to eventually sell the property, but can't sell it and is going to rent it. And with the proviso that if you rent it, you could at some point in the future buy it and at hopefully a favorable price. So I don't think, Gina, that anything that there's a downside to that, as long as you're paying a fair rent. And if perchance this is a property that you would eventually like to own, that might not be and perhaps you have to get into a little better financial situation. That would be a good thing to do. Any way you look at it, by the way, this is This is a perfect storm for home buyers, and in the most positive way, because you have record low interest rates and you have very low home prices. There are few certainties in life, but I will bet you dollars to donuts that 10 years from now, I can't say that anymore, Anne, because a donut costs about a dollar. You know, I'm
it
showing
costs
my
actually
age.
More than dollars.
Yeah.
So
I'll bet you whatever. 10 years from now, you're going to look back and say, "Golly, what a great time that would have been, 2012, to buy a house." And so whatever your situation, it's not easy to qualify to get a mortgage these days, but it's not impossible. And this is an auspicious opportunity. Gina and others, if you don't quite have the bread together to do it, don't worry. This market isn't going to come back anytime soon, unfortunately, or come back robustly, and interest rates will stay low. Incidentally, my memory serves me, Ann, we've had Jeff, Jason, Jim, and Gina. Mm-hmm. Asking questions. Do you have anybody without a J?
We do. We have one with a J and one without. So
okay.
I'll take the one without.
All right.
My guest is Jonathan Pond, PBS Financial Advisor, and you're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And we have an email from Susan. By the way, if you want to give us a call, you can, 614-292-8513. And if you want to email us, allsides@wosu.org. An email from Susan. I'm a 66-year-old, still working part-time, and wondered if I should pay off my mortgage. I have $49,000 left on my mortgage and just under 6% interest rate.
Mm-hmm. Susan, it's a little more complicated than that. I would think, depending, if you have adequate resources and they're not in retirement money, the last thing you want to do is take retirement money to pay it off.
Like 401k?
Like 401ks or IRAs, mm-hmm. because in order to have, say, $50,000 left to pay off the mortgage, you'd have to take out about 80 because you're going to pay taxes on it. But if you have the money outside the mortgage, outside retirement accounts, this could be something to do. Again, Susan, I talk a long time. It's a section of the program tonight that'll be here on WOSU TV. But you know, the issue is being mortgage free by the time you retire. So I laud your desire at age 66. There, it's not an either or decision either, Susan. If you may be working a few more years, why not pay an extra $1,000 a month against it, and then have it paid off by the time you fully retire. But good thinking on your part.
And then an email from Jan. She says, so many of us baby boomers are really confused about from whom and when to get long-term care. Mm-hmm. It's so expensive and hard to tell what's a decent deal. Can you help us?
Yeah. I've softened my approach on long-term care a little bit in the past. I think it is a way to buy peace of mind. It is a way for people who have accumulated sufficient resources to empower them to spend a little more when they retire, because they don't have to worry about all or some of the costs of long-term care. The policies are expensive, but there are ways to get around that. You can take a longer waiting period, say a 6-month waiting period before the benefits commence. You could get benefits that don't cover all of the costs of a nursing home, but cover half or 2/3 of the costs of a nursing home. So you can, if you find an agent or a company that is at all on your side and at least thoughtful, you should be able to get one that has a relatively attractive premium. Remember one thing, though, Jan, is that the companies are raising their rates, so you have to be prepared, and this worries me a little bit. You have to be prepared for the possibility that the rate may double at some point, the premium may double in the future. So people might, when they're 60 and still working, see a $2,000 premium and say, okay, I can afford that. And, well, they're working now. It's a lot more affordable than after you retire. And if that premium goes from $2,000 to $4,000 after you retire, that could be a real strain on the family budget. So I think there's a role for long-term care. if you want to play the percentages, and this is a sports area, you're always playing the percentages. You want to play the percentages, the chances are about 55% that you'll never collect a penny on the policy. So you can play the percentages, but that's, for many people, not a comforting way to approach your later life.
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, Jonathan. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Yep.
Hey, I have a question that, you know, I consider myself pretty well informed in terms of financial investments. I read more than the average guy. And when you talk to counselors, you hear a lot of diversification. And sorry, I'm getting a call ringing in, but I'm going to ignore it. But you hear a lot about diversification, and oftentimes you're encouraged to diversify your money between several mutual funds. Well, my thought is, by its very definition, a mutual fund is diversification.
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth the additional fees to put your money in, say, in several funds? And if it is, there's got to be some number where it's a diminishing return, right?
Yeah, Steve. Actually, there have been some studies on that, and there are diminishing returns, but they don't start to seriously diminish after about 15 different funds. And I could go through a list of funds you need. Yes, by definition, a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund is diversified, but it is within a certain category. Large cap, that's one fund. That's diversified, but only in large cap. Small cap, another one is mid cap. Government bond, corporate bond, municipal bond, foreign markets, emerging markets, which are the developing countries. One area of interest to me right now are foreign small cap stocks. So we're already up to about 10. Now, admittedly, every one of those is diversified within its particular area. But that's not diversification across a broad spectrum of investments, and that's what you need to do, because what you want to do is not try to hit home runs. You want to try to, again, I'm talking to a very knowledgeable crowd, you want to hit singles and doubles. That's the way you make the Hall of Fame. And the nice thing about being diversified as I described it, is that you're always going to have some money in areas that are thriving, but you'll never have too much money in areas that are diving. And you'll also resist the temptation. I had a call from a client today, an email from a client back in Boston, and she was really struck on palladium. I don't know what, you know, where can I get a palladium mutual fund? And I respond to her, wonderful Texas lady, I say, oh, I can find you something in palladium. Now, answer me this. Do you want me to put all of your money into it? And she'd say, oh, no, $2,000. But, you know, some people would hear a great story about palladium and say, I got to put all my money in there. And they get what they deserve, quite frankly. So I really appreciate your call, Steve. I was going to say I don't want to shill for the program tonight, but I do want to shill for it. And I actually go through how you actually diversify. And in 2 minutes, I explain diversification on the program because there's a clock on I didn't know about up on the upper left-hand side of the screen.
Steve, thanks for your call. Yeah?
Thank you.
Yeah, take care. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jonathan Pond, PBS financial advisor. And as he mentioned earlier, just a moment ago, he is going to be on WOSU TV tonight at 8. It's called Money Smarts with Jonathan Pond. He'll be there live in the flesh, just like he is in the studio right now. So,
such a delight to be here.
It is. It's great to have you
in
the studio.
What a great area of the country.
Yeah. Well, you know, Central Ohio, who knew?
Exactly.
It is a beautiful place. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
President Obama calls the bond between Israel and the U.S. unbreakable. It's a relationship, though, showing signs of strain, particularly on the issue of Iran. I'm John Donvan. Iran, Israel, and President Obama. Plus, the elders' perspective on caring for older parents. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4, right here on 89.7 NPR News. Stay with us in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday, a discussion of social media and politics, the Facebook timeline, and gadgetry. Join us for Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for the State House News Bureau stories on 89.7 come from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher educational faculty who are working for great public schools for every child. Online at ohea.org.
36 degrees with partly sunny skies in downtown Columbus. Expect sunshine throughout the day and a high of 55. Clear skies tonight, a low of 38 degrees. Some sunshine for Wednesday, even warmer, a high of 64. And then expect some rain showers on Thursday, but still a warm day with a high of 60 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking to PBS financial advisor Jonathan Pond. If you have a question or comment for him, get it in 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Ed in Columbus, thanks for holding because I really want to hear what Jonathan's answer to your question is.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Ed.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm about 60 years old, and I've been investing in tax-deferred annuities for about 16, 17 years, maybe 20. And I can, I've been investing mostly in 70% equity, I would say, 30% maybe other funds. And I've diversified large, small, foreign, and all that stuff. I'd like to park that money now in a little bit safer, not get out of the market completely, but within a safer arena, so I can have some sort of a income during my retirement years, which will be probably 6-7 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend people like me do to have, you know, to avoid these market swings up mm-hmm. and down and everything? But at this point, take that money from 401k, at least most of it, and take it to someplace else where I can have a secure income coming in.
Okay. Do you have, Ed, do you have these tax-deferred annuities? They're not inside retirement plans, right? They're outside?
They're outside, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Have a pension plan, and then this is outside that I have put my money into.
Did you put yourself into these, or did someone urge you to do that?
Well, I think I've heard this from the first day I got my job. Well, you have to put your money in some sort of tax-deferred annuities mm-hmm. Available to me. So I've been doing that.
Okay.
Through some companies.
All right. Well, the first thing you want to do is roll over your tax-deferred annuity. It's known as a Section 1035 exchange into one that has lower costs.
Okay.
I can give you some names. I mean, they're the usual suspects. Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, Schwab, Fidelity. At least then you won't be eaten alive with fees if that's the case, which it is with most of them. And as long as you don't pay a penalty, you've been in them for quite a while, you probably won't, roll them over into those. And then you could invest there more conservatively before you annuitize, which is where you'll get your income stream. So you could invest in them more conservatively simply by reducing your exposure from 70% stocks down a little bit. The one thing that I like about the aforementioned annuity companies is that their selections are pretty good. And some of the ones from the big insurance companies are pathetic. They're expensive and they're lousy performers. So you can at least get better performers and then you can invest a little more conservatively. However, Ed, you're 60. you have an investment horizon. You didn't get a really horrible report from your doctor last week, did you? No.
Are you pretty healthy, Dad?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm in very good shape.
Yeah, you've got a life expectancy of age 95, just like me, probably just like Ann, because, you know, only the good die young. So you don't necessarily want, you know, this is a big issue. Your age doesn't influence how you invest anywhere near as much as how long you're going to need the money to last. So you're going to need growth later on. And then what you do with these tax-deferred annuities, because it will be expensive to get out of them, is to gradually annuitize them after you retire. And again, hopefully interest rates will be up, annuity rates will be a little better, and then you can annuitize and draw the money out that way. Incidentally, this is an interesting thing. If perchance you're in a situation where you don't have to use the annuities, and if you're married, perhaps your spouse doesn't use the annuities, they can be passed on to your children and even grandchildren. They might not even be born yet, and they can receive these and get a lifetime income off them. They're an interesting vehicle from an estate planning standpoint, but I digress a little bit. Ed, I think you're on track. You're not in a situation now, particularly with interest rates as low as they are, where you want to reduce your exposure significantly. Look for good annuity companies with good and broad choices. Most of them have 50, 60 choices, most of which are pretty good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yep. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for my guest, Jonathan Pond. And Ben in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Hey, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to comment on a situation where a lady called in about the lease purchase.
Okay, please
home. The situation, this is actually from a personal experience that happened with me. I was involved with a lease purchase where I was going to be the one, I was leasing the house, and I was hoping to buy it. It was on a nice side in Columbus. And a number of months down the road, I had a knock on my door, and the gentleman was standing by my front door, happened to be the official owner of the house. The guy that I was buying the house from was actually buying it from him on a land contract, and it turned out that he wasn't paying him, and the owner showed up, asked me if I could pay him the money for the rent, since he was involved in that. And I went back to the guy that I was end up had leased the house from and found out that he actually didn't own the house.
Oh, and lovely.
I just want to say that in this day of when a lot of people, when you see these signs out that will buy your house for, you know, whatever you're selling the house for, and these guys are turned around and if they're selling it, I actually just told a friend of mine who just got involved in a lease purchase, I said, I don't know exactly what you need to do with going down to the clerk of courts or whatever, but the other side of it is finding out, number one, if that person owns the house, but the other side of it is that you never know when they go in default. And now with the mortgage companies delaying foreclosure action, you know, somebody could get burned. I got burned for several thousand dollars because a lot of these people asked for extra money up front on a lease purchase, and I never got my money back. And,
yeah,
you know,
well, that's good advice. And one thing I did mention to, I believe it was Susan or Gina, was
and start with a J.
It was Gina.
It was Gina. Okay, thank you, Ben, with a B. I did say, you know, pay a market rent. Don't pay but that's a fascinating and it could involve some checking out, because if this person just bought the house and is a speculator or a flipper, you don't want to be involved in that.
Yeah, it's hard to know for somebody. So
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
okay.
Thanks, Ben, for that. Appreciate it. Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I really enjoy the show, Ann. You do a great job there.
Thank you, Dan.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you pretty good, yeah.
Okay. All right. I work for UPS. We have an option there, taking our money from Prudential, the 401k, and investing it into Dreyfus. We can move it into dividend stock, which I did. I bought, I got 2,500 shares of AT&T, around 1,300 shares of UPS, and 678 shares of Ford.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering if I made the right choice. The reason I did that is the stock market moving up and down so much. I thought I'd go ahead and buy dividend stock, and so far it's worked pretty well for me. The dividends are, I'm reinvesting the dividends, going right back and purchasing more. And I'm 58 years old. I got a full defined pension plan from the company, so I'm doing fairly well, I think.
Sure.
I just want your opinion of it.
Well, Dan, I think that's that is a great way to go. I think back on how our forebears, the parents and grandparents, created financial security. The mutual funds weren't around that much at that time. What they did is they bought good dividend-paying stocks, enjoyed appreciation in value, and rising dividends. And I know some stocks that my grandmother gave me when I was 11, the dividends now are more than twice as much as she paid for the stock. And that's the way people created wealth. And by the way, when you have individual shares like that and you die with them, your heirs get what's known as a stepped-up basis so that the ill-deserving progeny can receive a benefit as well. I'm a strong advocate. And in this kind of market, which is shaky and is scary for people, dividend-paying stocks make a lot of sense. And I'm going to give you Dan is doing individual stocks. That's fine as long as you get a diversify within those stocks, within several. But let me give you the name of a couple of mutual funds that invest in dividend-paying stocks. And, I do this for a living, so I'm going to have to give you the symbols, and I don't know the names of them. I can try to replicate the names of them. But there are two symbols here. These are exchange-traded funds that invest in dividend-paying stocks, and they've done quite well of late. One is VIG. V as in Victor, IG. That's the Vanguard Dividend Appreciation Fund. And the other one is FVD, Frank Victor David. And that's it's the First Trust Value Line Dividend Fund. They don't have high dividends. They're paying a little over 2%. But it's a great way to go these days because the issue is, for those who are scaredy cats out there about the market, dividend-paying stocks, when the market declines, tend not to decline as much because the dividends they're paying as a percentage of the value of the stock are rising, and people are more attracted to those stocks. So I say hallelujah to you, Dan. It's a good way to go these days, and when you're getting 1% off CDs and you can get 2, 3, 4, 5% off stocks, that's not a bad way to go. Obviously, the CD doesn't go down. The stock can go down. But I think that's a risk worth taking.
5.8 yield, so that's pretty darn good.
Yes, it is. Yes,
okay.
It is. Thank you.
Dan, thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. We have an email from Tom. He says, I would like to know what your guest thinks about taking out a 401k loan to pay off credit card debt for someone who will not draw on the 401k for another 15 years or so.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, Tom. It's the first time I've ever been asked that question. If you feel confident that you can pay off the 401k loan, which in essence means you're paying yourself interest, but it isn't as good as it sounds, And you're not going to be paying off that loan for years and years and years, I would do that because the credit card debt almost certainly is very high interest, and you're substituting a lower interest debt for that. And do me the favor, though, Tom, don't become a debt recidivist when those credit cards are paid off. You know what I love? Boy, they're so old-fashioned. My kids say you are old-fashioned. Debit cards. Why not use debit cards? I think they're the savior for a lot of people.
You mean, but where you put a certain limit amount?
No, a debit card, you just go in, you pay for your groceries, you pay for anything else that comes directly out of your checking account.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I think, the way to go. So that's the issue, Tom. As long as those debt balances, you pay it off with your 401k, suddenly they think you're great. They increase your credit limit, who knows what. Don't go back in and repeat the issue.
Okay, Tom. Email from Chris. As I recently engaged 33-year-old man who has been late to launch due to factors within and outside of my control, my plan is to focus less on savings and more on paying off my roughly $5,000 in credit card debt and $6,000 in student loans. With nowhere near the 10 to 20% needed to put down on a house, is this an advisable path to keep?
Yeah. Oh, Chris, you're getting married. Never take financial responsibility for anything that eats, first of all. And Ann and I can say that to the third power with our children. But Dan, Chris, that's okay. I think, let me put it this way. I said earlier, nothing in your financial life is either or. I would get to work on paying down the credit cards. But I would take twice as long, because I would take half the money you might be able to afford to put toward the credit card and put that toward a 401k or 403b at work or an IRA. And the reason for that is paying off debts, particularly credit card debt, is not good for the soul. Putting money away for the future is good for the soul. So everybody would say, well, you know, these are such high interest rates. Why are you doing this? Pay off the credit cards ASAP. Don't do that. Take half the money, maybe a little less than half, and put it toward your future. You'll feel better about it, and 10 years from now, these will just be nasty memories.
You know, as usual, we didn't get to half of what I wanted to talk about, and we don't even have a pledge drive to blame it on.
Yeah.
But I did want to get to one quick thing. We only have about a minute left. Going into debt for college, yay or nay?
I take man on the street questions in the program tonight at 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. Money Smarts with Jonathan Pond. And I actually had a woman ask about that. A lot of debt for college is a big deal. It's a big deal for people in this environment. So do whatever you can. Cobble together scholarships. Maybe go to a lower-cost school. You don't want to come out of school with $100,000 in debt. And let me say this as a father. By the way, the father of one of them is a classics major. So do as I say, not as I do.
The opposite of an engineer.
Don't pick out majors where you're going to get a job or you have the likelihood of getting a job. That's important these days.
Well, Jonathan Pond, it's been a delight. Thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
And I'm so delighted, and I hope I'm invited back.
You certainly are. Any old time. You can watch Money Smarts with Jonathan Pond tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.